Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears back with you here on this Tuesday morning, August the 1st, 2023, 15 minutes past the hour, 66 degrees and sunny skies in the area here. And as many of you know, tomorrow is the centennial, the big centennial here in Marion, the 100th anniversary of the death of President Warren G. Harding, which also ended his presidency as President Harding died in office while on a trip in San Francisco, August the 2nd, 1923. Now, tomorrow morning, we've got a big morning scheduled from 8:15 until 9 a.m. We'll be joined by the grandson of President Warren G. Harding, Jim Blessing. It's the only interview he's giving tomorrow on this subject. 8:15 to 9 a.m., Jim Blessing, the grandson of President Warren G. Harding. And then from 9:15 tomorrow a.m. until 12 noon, we'll be joined in the studio by Warren G. Harding himself. Now, you figure out how we're going to make that happen tomorrow, but if you listen, you will enjoy, to be sure. And he's going to recount his final trip and his presidency and who knows what else during that three-hour period. Now, this morning, because of this big centennial tomorrow, I guess this is Centennial Eve, we are so glad to be joined by somebody who has been a guest on my program, the Glenn Coble program, the Adam Lepp program. Over several years now, he is an author, an historian, and here this morning to discuss the life and times, the good parts of President Warren G. Harding, Dr. Ronald Fineman. Dr. Fineman, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Scott. Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Yeah, now when we got together to discuss doing this, you said you wanted to cover the good parts of the life of President Harding. Why do you think that's overshadowed a lot?
It's overshadowed because of the scandals that erupted during his administration and also about his love life. So all the sensationalism has been about his love life and about the scandals surrounding him. Not that he personally was involved in the scandals, but that people around him were involved in scandals, people in his cabinet, but that still was part of his record. And most of this was not known until after he died. When he died, he was very popular, very high rating at the time. And then within a few years, we learned about his love life and we learned about the scandals and all that. And it really caused him to drop to the bottom five of our presidents. And that's where he still lodges. He's down there with Andrew Johnson, James Buchanan, Franklin Pierce, and Donald Trump. He's one of those five.
You know, it's very interesting because when we talk about love life, certainly Donald Trump, certainly Bill Clinton, certainly John Kennedy, Dwight Eisenhower, Lyndon Johnson. We all know that they had Roosevelt, certainly. Franklin Roosevelt. We all know that they had extracurricular activities in their marriage while they were president. But why does that hurt Harding more than others?
Well, I think it's because it's one of the first we knew about at the time. Not necessarily while he was over, so right after. All the others you mentioned came since. And I think we've been sort of like become immune to the idea that it matters to the same extent. But in his time, 100 years ago, it was a shock when we learned that the man we thought was such a wonderful man, and we mourned his death, of course, that suddenly we learned about his love life and also about the scandals of people in his cabinet. His is one of the most corrupt administrations, along with Grant, up to that time. And then since then, Nixon and Trump would be the others most.
Just to give people the full picture, and we are going to talk about the good things here, but for people who don't understand why you say it's one of the most corrupt, why do you say that?
Because of the number of people involved in scandals, the number of different issues that came up. It wasn't just one scandal, it was a whole group of scandals. And basically, he picked people that he thought he could trust, but he learned that he could not trust them. However, other than his own personal scandal, he was not personally involved in the scandals as Nixon was and as Trump is. So That's why he doesn't look as bad. Same with Grant. Grant, not personally involved, but people around him, and you're judged by the company you keep when you're a president.
Now, Teapot Dome is associated with President Harding continuously and has been for a long, long time now. Just a thumbnail sketch. What was Teapot Dome for people who don't understand?
Well, Teapot Dome is an actual location in Wyoming. It's an oil land area. And the Secretary of the Interior, Albert Fall, F-A-L-L, was there at that point, and he was involved with the deal taking bribes from the Sinclair Oil Company, and it became a major scandal that a lot of investigation was done, and it was just starting to be investigated when Harding died, and Harding left the White House to try to escape the scandal that was starting to erupt, and he traveled all the way to the West Coast and up to Alaska, which was, of course, a territory at the time, and then came back to San Francisco. But he was in poor health already in his third year, and I think the stresses of the job got to him, and he died on August 2nd, 1923 in San Francisco.
You know something, Dr. Feinman, 100 years since the man has died tomorrow, there are still people alive, obviously anybody 100 years and older, who would have been born when President Harding was president. They probably don't remember much about it, but they were born, their Harding babies are still alive. So it has not been a tremendous amount of time since the man was president of the United States. Yet here in the town that we live in and anywhere else, you know, this is really not getting much play at all. Why do you think that is?
Well, because he's not been rated as one of the better presidents. He's seen as a failure. So, like, he gets less attention, which I'm the way I'm sure that, that his grandson, I don't know what he's going to say tomorrow, but I think his grandson might be happy that there is less attention paid to his grandfather because so much of it has been negative for so long. And only after real investigation, as I have done and some others have done, do we realize, okay, he had a lot of bad points, but he also had some really great points. And I have 12 things that I want to mention in this hour. 12, that's a lot. So I do think, well, it doesn't take him out at the bottom 5 or 10. I think it does elevate him somewhat.
Well, 22 minutes past the hour here, so we can get them all in. Let's start.
Okay, let's begin with the fact that he won the presidency in a massive landslide by 26.2 percentage points, the largest popular vote percentage margin in presidential elections since James Monroe, who in 1820, 100 years earlier, had no opposition candidate. So he obviously had a bigger margin. And also, Harding had the greatest percentage winner of the popular vote, over 60%, higher than anybody up to that point. 60% of the total popular vote went to him. And he's the only first-time presidential winner to win 60%, while three presidents who were running for re-election did slightly better. Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1936, second term. Richard Nixon in 1972, second term. And Lyndon Johnson in 1964, full term, and Lyndon Johnson has the record of over 61%, but those four have between 60 and 61. But again, Harding is 60.1, and then comes FDR a little bit more, Nixon a little bit more, and LBJ a little over 61%. But they're all re-elections, so it's an amazing thing that he actually, in his first and only term, won 60% of the vote.
So we could say that as a president who had not been, it was not a re-election, somebody running for president, he still holds the record for the highest popular vote.
Yes, and I don't think ever will be broken. I can't imagine any first-term president winning 60% of the vote, really, in the political climate we're in now. There's no way that will ever happen to anybody.
Well, it's also interesting to note that that was the 1920 election, the first presidential election that women had the right to vote. How much do you think that figured into that?
Well, the indications are that while women did vote, I don't think they decided the election because I don't think the number of women who voted, I don't know exactly, was that high because that was still something new. So while there were women voting, it was not a decisive factor in getting 60%. It just added to the total. Maybe without them, he would have won 55, 57%. So I guess it helped to bring him up to 60%, but it's not as if they won the election for him, no.
Well, that definitely is a good point. Now let's move on to number 11.
Okay, number 11, okay.
Like a countdown here. We're doing like a countdown.
I have it as number 2.
Oh, number 2. Well, okay, we can go that way, too. Number 2 on the list. We'll start from the bottom.
Number 2 is he pardoned Socialist Party leader and 1920 presidential presidential candidate Eugene Debs for federal prison. He had been sentenced to prison for open opposition to the military draft during World War I under President Wilson, who would not give him a pardon. So he was actually pardoned by Harding. And interesting, of course, the point is that Debs is the only person ever to run for president and be on the ballot who was in prison at the time of the election. And now we could have Donald Trump being the second one.
Well, you know what's interesting about this Debs thing? Because there are two points to this that I find fascinating. Number one, he was put in prison under a Democrat, Woodrow Wilson,
yes,
and pardoned by a Republican, Harding. Now, a lot of people felt that would have gone the opposite direction.
Well, that's 100 years ago. Things were very different 100 years ago. The Democratic Party was heavily Southern and white supremacist at the time. So, and Woodrow Wilson, while he had good points, and he did, certainly has a lot of negatives, and his rating has gone down dramatically as far as how he's ranked as a president. He definitely had positives, and certainly is in the top half. But he has dropped dramatically Woodrow Wilson's reputation.
Now, for people out there, why was Debs imprisoned?
He was imprisoned for opposing the military draft in 1917 and speaking out against it. So he was put into jail under the Sedition Act of 1918, which was, I think, unconstitutional, but it was part of the law at the time. And you could not speak openly against the government's policy on the war, because we were in the Great War, as they call it, World War I. But also, I want to point out, not in his defense, but Wilson himself had bad health and would suffer a stroke in 1919. So in a way, maybe he wasn't in condition to have given him a pardon, because he was never himself again for the last 16 months, and honestly should have left the presidency. But instead, his wife, the second Mrs. Wilson, was said to have been the first woman president, in quotes, because she ran cabinet meetings. So, Wilson was not in the best shape to have done much of anything. He really should have left office, and Thomas Marshall, the vice president, somebody nobody remembers, could have been president for the for the remainder of that term, but it didn't happen. So it was a sad situation, the longest period of a president being incapacitated in U.S. history.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. Number three on the list.
Okay, this is interesting. It didn't happen, but he supported an anti-lynching bill in support of civil rights for African Americans in 1922. But get this, who blocked it? Southern Democrats, which is the way it was in the U.S. Senate. That was not going to be overcome until Lyndon Johnson overcame the Southern Democrats, of which he himself was a Southern Democrat. But he supported an anti-lynching bill, because lynchings were a very common theme, unfortunately, in the South and in the Midwest. And he spoke up for African-American rights, but he could not get it done. So it's a shame, but he did support it. And that's a big advancement for that particular period of time.
Correct me if I'm wrong here, Dr. Feinman, but did not Franklin Roosevelt, he didn't oppose it, but he could not support an anti-lynching bill when he was president. Is that right?
He was not willing to, unfortunately, to speak up and fight for it. He let his wife, Eleanor, speak up for it. He let his third-term vice president, Henry A. Wallace, speak up for it, and made enemies for Henry A. Wallace, and he was dropping the ticket for the fourth term when FDR ran in 44, and he picked Harry Truman, who, ironically, when he's in office, does promote civil rights, even though nobody in the South thought he would. So it worked out in the end quite well, but Wallace suffered a lot as far as his reputation, because he was seen as a, quote, troublemaker. And Eleanor Roosevelt, people didn't think the First Lady should even be speaking up on anything. But FDR was not willing to, because of the war effort, to do anything much about it, to speak up on it, unfortunately.
Well, and there also is a speech that Harding, I believe, gave in Birmingham at that time, which was, of course, heavily segregated while he was president. And if you listen to that speech, that the equality that he talks about between African Americans and Caucasian Americans, for a Republican president to be giving that speech in Birmingham at that time, I can only imagine how the crowd reacted.
Yes, of course, Birmingham was the most segregated city in the South, even in the 1960s, when we had Bull Connor as their sheriff, and he had people being attacked with water hoses and everything else. And that was the time of Martin Luther King, and it is a disgrace the way Alabama was. But really, Alabama is not very good right now, as they're denying one congressional seat to an African American. They're refusing to reapportion their seats under gerrymandering rules, and so they're in trouble, and their Senator Tuberville, of course, is blocking military promotions over the issue of abortion for women in the military. So Alabama is back to its old image that it had with George Wallace and Bull Connor 60 years ago, very sadly.
So first president to support an anti-lynching bill.
Yes.
Very good.
But not able to get it done. But that's always the case. Unless you get the votes and you can overcome the filibuster, you can't get everything done. But we got to give him credit for the fact that he promoted that.
And in the early 1920s, which is certainly a different time than when Lyndon Johnson was able to get some things done.
Yes. One other thing I wanted to mention is there were rumors, I don't think it's ever been proved, there were people at the time, maybe because he spoke up on that, who were saying that thought that he might actually have African-American blood. They were claiming he might be the first president who wasn't, quote, totally white, end quote. And that was never shown to be true, and I don't care if it was. But there were statements like that. But I think that's more just like a character assassination attempt by people who were against what he was speaking for.
I think that's probably more apt than, the stories that came. Because if there's no proof, it's hard to say definitively. Next on the list.
Okay, fourth is, and this is really interesting, a bill was passed, he signed in 1921, the Shepard, S-H-E-P-P-A-R-D, Towner, T-O-W-N-E-R, the Shepard-Towner Maternity Act, the first major federal government social welfare program in the nation. It set the trend for New Deal social programs during the next decade. This had to do with pregnant women and their young children. This was really quite an amazing thing, to do something about women, most, I guess, poor, who needed some kind of federal support. So it's the first social welfare program, and it's under a Republican.
Well, that's interesting because we all now know since 2015 that he, tending to the bad side, I guess, here for a second, that he, in 1919, got Nan Britton pregnant, who was a rather young lady compared to him. And by all accounts, he knew that this baby, Elizabeth Ann, was born. So, maybe that's what he was thinking about, because Nan Britton certainly was an unwed mother of his child of that time.
Yes, and I should mention, and I do bring this up in class, in case people are falling asleep early in the day, I bring it to wake them up. I said, when he started to deal with Nan Britton, he was 45 years old, and she was 14. So that was statutory rape, if you think about it. Not when she got pregnant, but that's when their relationship began.
Yeah, but do we really, because I've seen some of the letters that were exchanged between Nan and Warren Harding. Do we know that their intimate relationship actually started at that point? There was a correspondence in which she was trying to get a job and he was writing letters of recommendation for her. But
yes.
Do we really know when the relationship, the physical part of it started?
Well, I'm not a Harding scholar, but there are Harding scholars who have said, yes, it did begin. Not the pregnancy right then, but that the intimate relations did begin at that big difference in age, 45. Because she was a next-door neighbor's daughter in Marion, Ohio. So I don't know, I'm going by what Harding scholars have said.
I'll have to ask the grandson about his grandma tomorrow and see if she ever said anything.
Okay.
It'd be interesting to know.
Number five is he signed into law, and this is interesting, the Federal Aid Highway Act of 1921, promoting federal funding of interstate and intercounty roads, a forerunner of the interstate highway system promoted by President Eisenhower, another Republican president, in the 1950s. I think that's really fascinating.
And Eisenhower is very well applauded for that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, he's the second Republican, I always like to say, who promoted transportation growth, the other being Lincoln with the Transcontinental Railroad in the 1860s.
Just because I think we've left this, I want to go back to the last one for a second that came to pregnant mothers. What exactly did that bill do?
It gave some aid and assistance to women who were in need, I guess, probably poorer women. And it was a program that was kept until the 1930s when it was improved upon by the New Deal of FDR.
All right. Number six on the list.
Okay, so federal highway, that's really interesting, though, with the interstate highway, the beginning of that. Okay, number six, very important, certainly for you and WWGH, he promoted the development of the radio industry, which was advocated by his Secretary of Commerce, Herbert Clark Hoover, Herbert Hoover, the future president. He was a big promoter of radio, and it was his election was the first announced on the radio as far as radio actually announcing presidential election results in 1920. But he really promoted Hoover really promoted the radio industry.
Now, is he not the first president who ever spoke on the radio as well?
Yes, he was. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's an interesting thing, because presidents ever since then have given radio addresses.
Yes.
Yep.
And of course, television, which is something that people couldn't imagine, you know, that could be so. But yes. All right. Number seven, and this is important. It's under his administration, the Bureau of the Budget, the nation's first formal budgeting process, was created, and that still exists. The Bureau of the Budget. It's a federal agency.
Now, what does the Bureau of the Budget do?
It's supposed to set up a budgetary guideline, which, of course, is always being fought over every year. And right now, we're going to have the battle in September over what's going to happen with the budget for the next year. And there might be a shutdown of the government again, hopefully not. But it's supposed to try to control spending on both domestic and foreign policy.
Now, do we know that why this would have been such a thing for Harding in the early 1920s?
I think a lot of it had to do with the fact of the national debt that was developed by the First World War. We had a massive national debt that developed because no matter how much we raised taxes and all that, the fact is that spending on a world war, as we got involved in 1917 and 18, and its aftermath, would be very costly. And that became, by the way, an idea that his successor, Calvin Coolidge, who will become president on August 3rd, 1923, he will promote the ending of the deficit, and he does, with always, with all the negatives people say about Coolidge, and a lot of them do, he actually does, in his administration, Coolidge retire the national debt as he leaves office. Then Hoover comes in, not intending, but with the Great Depression coming on, we go into a national debt, and the budgetary issue becomes a controversy that's still with us today.
Next on the list.
Okay, number eight. He signed legislation creating the Veterans Bureau to deal with those who served in America's wars, going back to the Civil War, Spanish-American War, and World War I. And the point is, the Veterans Bureau, it was the head of the Veterans Bureau who, however, was one of the people involved in scandal, unfortunately. But the point is that the Veterans Bureau would be the government agency for veterans until under Ronald Reagan, we would get the Department of Veterans Affairs in 1988.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that I always bring up to people, because this is something that I think gets left behind in President Harding's legacy. And I would imagine, again, we can't get into the man's head, but I would imagine this is probably happening because World War I has just taken place.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean,
and
a lot of...
it is important.
Yeah.
Imagine, first when you think back, you say, gosh, the Civil War, yeah, it was 50 years earlier. Of course there were Civil War veterans still around. They were around at the time of the Depression, even. Some people lived to be 100, so there were a lot of Civil War... even some probably Mexican War veterans might have been around still.
So, you had Civil War veterans, for sure. You definitely had a lot of World War I veterans who had just fought years prior to this, a few years prior. So,
yeah.
when we look at this, do we know really in Harding's day how close his Veterans Bureau is close to what now we know as the VA?
Well, it's similar to it, but of course it was small scale. But unfortunately, apparently Charles Forbes, the head of the Veterans Bureau, was involved in taking bribes, and he ended up becoming extremely wealthy, and he ended up being indicted. He's one of the number of people under Harding who were indicted, and we're not saying Harding was aware of it, but again, the argument is he's supposed to be aware of what's going on around him, and I think there's a case to be made for any president, anybody who does anything scandalous, and it's under your leadership, you have to take some responsibility for it.
But the VA survives today, so that's the good part of it.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Next on the list.
Okay, number nine, again with Herbert Hoover, his Secretary of Commerce, promoted the development of the aviation industry. Air travel was beginning. It started, of course, with the Wright brothers, but it was really a big promotion under Herbert Hoover and under Harding and Coolidge.
Now, what type of things did they do?
Well, they promoted the idea of new kinds of aircraft engines and trying to figure out what routes would make sense, as far as travel. It was still early times, but the point is that Hoover, and I'm going to talk more about Hoover in a moment, Hoover was really significant as Secretary of Commerce, and he really was a major figure. And honestly, out of the three presidents of the 20s, Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover, Hoover is considered by far, although he's a tragic figure because of the Depression, is seen as the most brilliant cabinet, one of the most brilliant cabinet members we've ever had, and a real star in the cabinet of Harding and Coolidge.
Hmm. That's very interesting. On to the next one.
This next one is very important. Appoints four in 2.5 years, four Supreme Court justices. Imagine that's old timing. And I thought, I looked into that, how many of the court appointments, it's always, it's just the way it worked out, has favored the Republican Party since the early part of the 20th century. I mean, President Taft himself earlier appointed six in one term of 4 years. It just worked out that way. Harding appoints four. And then we have Eisenhower has five, and Nixon has four, and Reagan has four, and Trump has three. It's amazing how much, you know, Republicans have had the luck to have most of the time that when Supreme Court appointments come up, they're in office. Anyway, he appoints four Supreme Court justices, including most significantly a Chief Justice. And who is that Chief Justice? Former President William Howard Taft.
Absolutely. And I think, do we know why he did this? Because I don't think he had a relationship with former President Taft.
Taft had a, you know, even though Taft had only one term in office and lost re-election massively because of Theodore Roosevelt being on the third-party progressive boom moose ticket, and Wilson won because of that. Wilson never would have been president without T.R., Teddy Roosevelt challenging Taft. But I think Taft was seen as a constitutional scholar. He was a professor at Yale after being president, and he had always wanted to be on the court, and he had had good relationships with Republican leaders, and when Chief Justice Edward Douglas White retired, the point was that it came up that they thought that Taft would add stature to the court. And actually, of course, he did, not only because he was a former president, but he also, in his 9 years that he was Chief Justice until his passing in 1930, he managed to promote the idea that the Supreme Court should have its own building, not be part of the U.S. Capitol in the old Senate chamber where they met. And the planning for the Supreme Court building began. It did not come about to fruition until 1935, 5 years after his death. But the Supreme Court building and the whole story about it is due to Chief Justice Taft.
So these were good justices that he promoted.
Well, that one. The others on the others he picked, a couple of them ended up being what were later called, quote, the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, which meant they were extreme in the image of the history. Extreme right-wingers who opposed the New Deal and led to FDR trying to pack the court, in quotes, because he was trying to overcome their opposition to the New Deal. So the others don't have such a good reputation. And one of them also was very anti-Semitic and had trouble dealing on the same court with Justice Brandeis, the first Jewish member of the court, appointed by Wilson. There was a lot of bad blood there. So the others are not seen as great reputations, but Taft was, and it did impact the court in the 1920s. However, the court overall was very conservative, said to be the most conservative it was until now. In the 2020s, we have a very conservative court again, 100 years later.
You know, that's an interesting dichotomy of the man, because we've already talked about he promoted the first social welfare program for women, unwed mothers, and
yes.
He also supported the anti-lynching bill, first president to do that, and then he appoints judges who are against social welfare and, as you said, racist. So there you go.
Well, because the thing is, you never really know what a person's going to do when they're on the court. You know, and of course, people do evolve. Some people do evolve, like Justice John Paul Stevens, appointed by Gerald Ford in 1975, was said to be conservative. And by the time he left, 35 years later, almost the old-time record, not quite, he was seen as a flaming liberal, in quotes. So people do change. Justice Brennan is another such case. When he was appointed by Eisenhower, William Brennan, he thought, oh, he's Catholic, which was a rare thing, and he's conservative. He turned out to be very liberal, and there's a Brennan Center for Social Justice at New York University. So you never really know what can be sure of the future of members of the court. They do evolve.
This is true. On to the next one.
Number 11, here we bring up Herbert Hoover again as Secretary of Commerce, regarded as one of the best cabinet officers, not because I say it, but in any ranking of cabinet members, you say, well, you talk about being Secretary of State or Secretary of Defense or Secretary of the Treasury or Attorney General. Yeah, generally. But actually, he's in Commerce, which we don't think of as being as significant, but actually he is rated as one of the very, very best cabinet members we've ever seen in all of U.S. history, Herbert Hoover. So he had great credentials when he ended up running for president. He had never run for office. He'd always been appointed. But he turns out to, of course, be seen as a tragic figure in the presidency because of the Great Depression and its slow reaction to take action on it.
Now, isn't it true that a lot of people, because of his popularity, wanted Hoover to run in 1920?
Yes, actually, Herbert Hoover was seen as a possible candidate in 1920. And actually, get this, he was working for Wilson. He was bipartisan. He was working for Woodrow Wilson. And he got to know Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and they were good friends in 1920, and FDR in 1920 figured that Wilson wouldn't be running again because he had a stroke, suggested that his good friend Hoover should consider running. Hoover ended up not doing that, and Republicans did not consider him, I think because he was connected to Wilson at the time. But what's ironic is, what happens in 1920? Who opposes Harding and Coolidge? James Cox, the governor of Ohio. So both candidates are from Ohio. Governor Cox of the Cox Newspaper Corporation, Cox Newspapers, and Harding. But who is his running mate? FDR is his running mate for VP. And they end up losing massively, Cox and FDR. And who would think 12 years later, FDR, after being on the losing ticket as VP, would end up winning the White House against his old friend, and now they're bitter enemies and they would never talk to each other again. It's just an amazing story.
But probably mostly because of the Depression, though. I think that because Hoover wins his first election very handedly.
Yes, and, 58% of the vote.
Yeah,
yes.
Doesn't become unpopular until the Depression, and FDR uses that. I think had there not been a Depression, it might have been much more difficult for FDR to defeat Herbert Hoover.
Well, I think the whole idea that somebody running for VP could be on a losing ticket, it's massively losing, and then come back to become president. I've joked to people and I've said, well, you know, I'm joking here. I said, I can think of someone else who ran for VP on a losing ticket, not as massively losing, but losing, and maybe he could come out of the woodwork, and he's not going to. I'm talking about Paul Ryan, who ran with Romney in 2012. That it's 12 years since he lost in vice presidency, but and because he's not running, there's no indication he is. But it's just ironic. It's such a long shot to think that FDR could have done that.
See, for a second there, I thought you were talking about Sarah Palin.
No. My gosh, no.
You never know. No. Mike Pence. You never know.
And Mike Pence is a big dud. He can't even raise enough money to, enough support to even be on the debate. At this point, it's very sad because even though I'm not a fan of his, I think he did the right thing about what happened on January 6th, and we have to give him credit for that. Anyway, also other than Hoover, part of the 11th point I want to make is the Secretary of State is one of the best ever, Charles Evans Hughes, H-U-G-H-E-S, and what a background this guy has. He was a member of the Supreme Court appointed by Taft in 1910. He had been governor of New York before that as a progressive Republican. That was the time when we had some progressive Republicans. And he went on the court. And then in 1916, he resigned from the court to run for president. He ran against Wilson. And I've always said that 1916 election was probably the best, in quotes, election we've ever had, because even though Wilson, we later would see faults, he looked pretty damn good in 1916 at the end of his first term, and we weren't in war. And Hughes had a tremendous background as governor of New York and on the Supreme Court. And that election ended up, amazingly, the closest electoral vote election other than 1876, Hayes versus Tilden. And it was only won because of California, by small margin, going to Wilson over Hughes. He almost, Hughes, won the presidency, but he didn't challenge the result. And then he went back into private life. And in 1921, he's appointed Secretary of State under Harding, and he's there. And then he will stay to 1925 until the end of that term under Coolidge. He will not stay on. But then in 1930, he will be appointed by President Hoover to be, get this, Chief Justice. So he's on the court first as an Associate Justice from 1910 to 16, runs for president, loses, then as Secretary of State in the first 4 years of the 20s, and then as Chief Justice, 1930 to 1941, only one of 17, which is interesting. There's only been 17 Chief Justices. And he would become famous for a line he proclaimed during the 1930s when he was Chief Justice. And I always say this in every class when I talk about the Supreme Court. I say to the students, this is a sentence that is loaded. It's sort of like simple, but really is complex if you think about it. They look at me and wonder, what do you mean? And he listens to this. The quote is, quote, "The Constitution is what the Supreme Court says it is." 10 words, but boy, is that a loaded sentence. The Constitution is what the Supreme Court says it is, and that's been proved recently, hasn't it?
Certainly has. So good.
And I wanted to mention 1876 is actually the closest election by one electoral vote, and of course 1916 was 277 to 254 in the electoral vote. But actually, since then, the election of 2000 was closer. It was only a 4-vote margin, 271 to 267. So actually, the 1916 election is the third closest electoral vote margin ever, because in 2000 came after. And I've done lectures on these three elections, you know, 1876, 2000, and 1916, the closest electoral vote elections. And it could happen again, of course, in the future.
Yep, you never know. All right, I believe this is our final point.
Yes, and it relates to Hughes. It's under Harding and Hughes that we had the Washington Naval Conference of 1921-22, and was the world's major naval powers on a naval disarmament program that endured for a decade, only a decade, unfortunately, because in 1931, Japan invades northern China, Manchuria, and therefore the Washington Naval Agreement fails. But that's not the fault of Harding or Hughes. That's just circumstance. But it was a naval disarmament treaty. The only problem with it is it did not include the Soviet Union in it, because nobody wanted to recognize the Soviet Union, you know, and also Germany was not in it, but Germany had been demilitarized. They didn't have a military at the time. So we're just talking about the major naval powers, the United States, Britain, France, and Japan, and Italy also.
Now, we just went down, we have about 9 minutes left here. We went down 12 good points about President Harding's administration. He was there for 3 years, 1921.
2 years and 5 months.
2 years and 5 months, 1921 to 1923. But if he had lived, do you think it would have changed anything?
The thing is, you know, the Republicans were the majority party in the country. They had been since the Civil War's end. The only Democrat who had ever won was Grover Cleveland in 1884, and then in 1892, and then Woodrow Wilson, who only won because of the split of the party, Republican Party, and then very closely against Hughes. The Republican Party would have been favored, but I don't know, with the scandals erupting that were coming out and investigations going on in Congress, I'm not sure what would have happened if he had run again. If he could, I guess he would have been the nominee. That's a really interesting what if. I would say still the Republican Party would have been in favor, because the Democratic Party was really badly split between two factions, the Southern Democrats, who were, of course, white supremacists, and the growing number of immigrants who had become citizens in the cities of the North, Jews and Catholics particularly. And in 1924, when Coolidge was running for a full term, we had the Democratic National Convention in New York City at the original Madison Square Garden, and all the Southerners who came were upset. They didn't want to have the New York, as they said, it's full of all these despicable people, Jews, Catholics, and ends. I'm not going to say what the word is, but they would use that term about people who were African-American. And they had the longest convention in U.S. history, 2.5 weeks, battling over who should they nominate. And the favorite for the Northern Democrats, which was starting to become more influential, was the governor of New York, Alfred E. Smith, who was Irish Catholic. Oh, my God, a Catholic running. Oh, my God. You know, horrible. And it went on and on for 103 ballots to pick not him and not the Southern favorite, who was someone else, but rather attorney for West Virginia, John W. Davis, I think the most obscure candidate ever we've had of a major party, John W. Davis, West Virginia. And, of course, that caused liberals and progressives who were unhappy to form a third party, a second progressive party. Robert La Follette Sr., Mr. Progressive in Wisconsin, ran as his candidate. and they won his home state, just his home state of Wisconsin. But my Jewish grandfather, I learned years later, and a lot of other Jewish and Catholic former immigrants who have become citizens, voted for LaFollette, and he ended up winning 16% of the vote as a protest against Coolidge and Davis, because Davis was seen as a disaster, really, but that was the compromise choice of the 1924 Democratic Convention. And one more point about John W. Davis, he's not just running then. Imagine this, 30 years later, he's in the news again. I couldn't believe it when I learned about this. 1954, he's in a very important Supreme Court case, Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, about the ending of segregation in public schools. And whose side is he on? The school board to prevent integration. Imagine that. So, what a story this is.
You know, one thing that fascinates me about Harding, and always has, because of his presidency, Herbert Hoover was a part of it. He was a very popular figure of the time. And, of course, Hoover goes on to become president later on. And also, he appoints Taft to the Supreme Court. And Taft had been a president, an Ohio president, nonetheless. Yes. And yet, there really is no record of Harding having any type of really close relationships with either of these people, and really no close relationships with people in his inner circle. It just seemed like it was his friends that had always been his friends, that he wasn't, maybe much of a political socialite.
Well, the thing is about Harding is that it's clear from what we know that he really didn't want to be president. The Republican Party was looking for someone that would not be a crusader like a Wilson or a T.R., and his own wife pushed him to run for president. And he actually made a statement at one point that we learned that says that, you know, that he didn't like being president. He felt stressed by it because people he thought were his friends were doing corrupt things around him. And, you know, he's being blamed for it. But, of course, because you are blamed. So, I mean, I think he was close to Hughes, though, the Secretary of State at the time, and later Chief Justice. But I think that he felt he was like almost not good enough for the job. I think he had a low self-opinion about his ability to be president. And I don't think he really was looking forward to running in 1924, when I look back to it. But an interesting point about Coolidge, I just want to be sort of like interesting. Coolidge is going to be president suddenly, and he's going to run for a full term. But during the campaign, and this is shocking, his youngest son, Calvin Jr., dies at age 16. He got an injury on his foot playing tennis on the White House tennis courts, and nothing was done about it. And 5 days later, he passed away. It's unbelievable. It's age 16. So he was in depression from that, obviously. And it's been pointed out that his first year as president, Coolidge was quite a talker. He had press conferences, and he was friendly and warm. And then suddenly he clammed up, and he stopped holding press conferences, and he became the man who said very little and was made fun of, that he was not a person who really communicated. And I think he was basically in depression for the full term he served. And that's, I think, why, although we don't know for sure, why he announced in 1927 when he could have run again, I'm not going to run in 1928. So it's a very tragic situation.
We've got about 2.5 minutes left here, and I want to remind people that tomorrow is the centennial, the actual date, 100th anniversary of the death of President Warren Harding. He died on August the 2nd, 1923, and tomorrow morning, starting at 8:15, we will have an exclusive interview, live interview, with the grandson of President Warren G. Harding, Jim Blessing. And following that, we will have Warren G. Harding with us live from 9:15 a.m. until 12 noon, and he will talk about that ill-fated trip that he died on in 1923 while in San Francisco, and also some things in his presidency, and I'm sure he'll read some speeches tomorrow, and that's an extended version of this program tomorrow. We'll start at 8:15 a.m. and run through noon tomorrow, so don't miss that.
That should be interesting.
Yeah, it's going to be great. That's going to be a fascinating show. Now, Dr. Feinman, as we put a cap on this, less than 2 minutes, what do we end up saying about President Harding, the man? Well, where does he go? We know what his political life's like. What's the man like? What do we know about him?
I think he's certainly not an egomaniac like some of our presidents have been. Far from it. I think he's basically a regular guy who felt actually that he was overwhelmed by the job that he had to deal with, because he learned that it wasn't so easy. It's nice to be elected, but the job itself, he just, I don't think, was fully prepared for. And I think it made him depressed, and I think it undermined his health and caused his heart troubles. And, you know, when he went up to Alaska, and some people, even at the time, critics were saying he's going as far as Alaska is to escape everything, as far as you could go in the United States. And I do think that he felt that he was under siege, and he was, but that's part of being president, and I don't think he could handle it very well. And in that sense, it's a sad situation, what happened.
Absolutely. Dr. Feinman, thank you for coming on. It was a pleasure on the eve of the centennial of the death of President Warren G. Harding. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Dr. Ronald Feinman, presidential historian, author, and many-time guest on this program, as well as Adam Lepp and Glenn Coble's program. Well, tomorrow's the day. Don't stray too far. Starts at 8:15 tomorrow. We're going to celebrate President Harding from 8:15 a.m. until 12 noon, an historic day here in Marion. For this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM LP, Marion, Ohio.
I'm Charlie Evers, and I'll be on 10 to 12 today, and welcome your phone calls. Today, I'm going to leave it up to all of you to ask questions.
I want you, who are listening today, to invest your time and energy in this radio station.